Herzlich willkommen zu unserer nächsten Panel-Session hier im Hyper Lab, im Hyper Motion Lab. Es wird spannend. Wir kommen zum Thema Hyperloop. Aus meiner völligen Laienperspektive sieht das nach so einer noch Zukunftstechnologie aus und fast nicht vorstellbar, dass das hier zum Beispiel in Deutschland, Europa schnell realisiert wird. Aber wenn man schaut, wer sich alles hinter dem Projekt steckt, wer alles dem Projekt zuarbeitet, wer sich damit beschäftigt, dann scheint das wirklich ernst zu nehmen zu sein und vielleicht schon in mittelbarer Zukunft sehr greifbar zu werden. Daher bin ich persönlich sehr gespannt, was die verschiedenen Stakeholder, die wir gleich auf der Bühne sehen, dazu sagen werden und was so der Status quo ist, was die Aussicht ist, wann man sich vielleicht das erste Mal da reinsetzen kann und vor allem, was der Unterschied sein wird, damit das nicht endet wie der Transrapid, sondern tatsächlich umgesetzt wird. Und ich denke, da werden wir jetzt die geballte Ladung an Insights bekommen. Ein sehr hochkarätig besetztes Panel. Moderiert wird es wieder von Martin Fröhlich, Head of der New Horizons bei der Deutschen Bahn. Das ist so eine kleine Einheit, die sich um die besonders disruptiven Geschäftsmodelle kümmert, die auf die Bahn zukommen können. Sei es eben wie heute Hyperloop oder gestern die Passagierdrohnen. Also eine kleine Einheit, so ein bisschen vielleicht vergleichbar mit Google X, die besonders weit voraus ausdenken und nicht nur ihre eigene Suppe kochen, sondern vor allem auch viele Stakeholder zusammenbringen und so ein bisschen auch als die Kommunikationsschnittstelle dienen für andere Unternehmen oder auch Ministerien und dergleichen und Startups. Herzlich willkommen, Martin.
Ja, danke. Ihr dürft auch klatschen. Das soll ja hier nie irgendwie eine Spaßveranstaltung sein. So, in diesem Sinne, mein Name ist Martin Fröhlich. Danke erstmal für die warmen und einleitenden Worte von meinen Kollegen. Freue mich hier da zu sein als Wiederholungstäter, freue mich ganz besonders und mir ist es ganz besonders wichtig, dass hier eine Diskussion zustande kommt. Demnach freue ich mich, dass ihr so zahlreich erschienen seid. Schreibt schon mal eure Fragen auf. Wir haben da einen Bildschirm links und rechts. Könnt ihr eure Fragen an eine Domain sozusagen senden. Zackes, könntest du diese Domain noch mal kurz sagen oder einblenden? Das lief ja gestern wundervoll, das war Slimdo. Genau, da steht schon. Da könnt ihr praktisch eure Fragen hinsenden und dann erscheinen die hier letztendlich auf dem Board, sodass wir die im Anschluss beantworten können. Das wird so ablaufen, dass wir 60 Minuten hier einen Diskurs führen mit den Panelisten und danach würde ich das gern öffnen für Sie, meine Damen und Herren, für eine Diskussionsrunde, eine effiziente, charmante und diskussionsfreudige. Lasst uns starten. I will switch to English right now. My name is Martin Fröhlich, Head of New Horizons, and now we will start. If you want to have a translator, there is a man inside the box. He will translate it in German language, so you can have a phone or a headphone or something like a translator you can put in your ears. Now let us start. Rail meets Hyperloop is a topic for today. And a warmly, warmly welcome to the first person. She is the CEO of Hyper Poland. Warmly welcome to Kasia Foljani. Nice to meet you. Nice to see you again here in Frankfurt. The next person, he is one of the, one of the founders of the team of War Hyperloop. It is called now TUM Hyperloop from the University, Technical University of Munich. A warmly welcome to Gabriele Semino here on stage. So, I tried to get all the Hyperloop initiatives and startups on that stage, and I'm also very happy that a friend of mine is coming. His name is Mars Goetze, the CEO of Hard Hyperloop from Hard Hyperloop from Holland. Warmly welcome. Also, warmly welcome to Professor Rumpf from the School of Management. Applause. The next person who is coming, I'm working with her together since several months. She is from DB Engineering and Consulting, and we are trying and we want to start a feasibility study on the Hyperloop topic, which role could Hyperloop, which role could Deutsche Bahn in the Hyperloop ecosystem? A warmly welcome to Katharina Diek from DB Engineering and Consulting. That guy came with a train from France. He was one of the parts and the game changers at, he is the game changer of SNCF. And he was responsible also for the investment from SNCF into Virgin Hyperloop in 2016. A warmly, warmly welcome to Bertrand Minary. Where are you? I give you my hand, my friend, because we have a warmly update. Thanks. And the last guy, he tried to came with a train from Holland. His name is Kai Morg, and he will come hopefully 15 or 20 minutes later. Hopefully he is coming, but I think so. Now we are... No. And also we have here in the first Reihe, sozusagen Zeleros. He came also from Spain. A warmly welcome that you are here. Would you like to come on stage with me? Because this is spontaneous what I'm doing here in interaction. So thanks that you are coming. I think now we have all the main Hyperloop initiatives from Europe here on stage. So this is premiere for you guys. A warmly applause. So let us start with the topic. What is a Hyperloop and what is the differentiation between the Transrapid? Who wants to answer that fruitful question, Mars? Would you like to start, my friend?
I'll start, yes. Does this work?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, perfect. A good first question that we immediately start with the Transrapid. I think an important point to take there is that Transrapid was, first of all, a brilliant new technology where we really made a big difference in terms of some of the maintenance costs and the operations costs because of the use of magnetic levitation instead of moving wheels. So that was one of the big sort of breakthroughs that are necessary to bring a real new, transport rail technology off the ground. What is still lacking there is that although you can go much faster without the problem of the wheel-wheel interaction, you still have a lot of aerodynamic drag because as you're going through the air, the aerodynamic resistance goes quadratically with your speed. So as you go faster and faster, you also use more and more energy. So to really bring this all together, to really make use of the magnetic levitation system, you would also actually want to have some kind of a way to remove the air, to also remove that aerodynamic resistance, and to really get all the benefits that you can get from maglev as well. An extra addition of this is that because there's a tube around the Hyperloop, and therefore, with a low pressure environment, you can have quite a small tube. The nice thing about this tube is that you're completely isolated from external environment. So there's no wind, there's no rain, there's no snow, there's no leaves on the track, there's no birds that can fly into the motors. So basically there's an entire new infrastructure addition there that really helps make this a step further from maglev. It's sort of an evolution almost.
Great, thanks. So everybody can hear us quite well, is it okay for you? Did somebody need a translator or somebody who can help, like a personal assistant? Put your hands up in the air. No? Then it's nice.
Martin, so, I would like to say something about the Transrapid.
Yeah? Of course.
There was also one key point on the Transrapid that needs to be addressed, is that the solution technically was awesome, but from the infrastructure cost, it was extremely expensive. One of the questions was, or one of the issues was that the linear motor was present, and the linear motor, it's a lot of coils, put it together, electronically controlled, and that's expensive. So there's also something that we need to address when we think on which is the future of Hyperloop. Is the first question is, how can we make this cheaper? And one of the solutions could possibly be, let's remove the linear motor and let's find another solution for propulsion.
Thanks. So, Kasia, I was several weeks ago at the opening ceremony of the Hyper Poland test track, 48 meters long in Warsaw. Thanks for inviting me. What is your plan? What you are doing there? What are the next steps? And what is your unique selling proposition of Hyperloop Poland? Question mark.
So we are talking about the Hyperloop here, but Hyperloop is a completely new mode of transportation, and it takes a lot of time to implement this kind of solution, especially in Europe. So our company started to develop the technology from a little bit different angle. We said that we need the transition states before we'll get to the Hyperloop itself. And we started to develop the magnetic levitation train, which is actually moving on existing railway infrastructure. We are adding a linear motor, which was mentioned here before, between the existing tracks. So in this way, the normal conventional train can move on the tracks as before, but our vehicles can move on the same tracks as well. The costs are estimated to be much lower than building the new high-speed train routes and lines. In this way, we can test our technology, which later will be implemented for the Hyperloop system much earlier, and we can develop it more or change it when it needs to be changed. We are not developing at the very beginning the new mode of transportation. We are actually upgrading the railway transport, which is struggling with a lot of problems right now. So they can have a new product, they can have a new ways how to, for example, change the cargo transportation from road to rail and how to deal with this kind of problems.
Great, thank you, Kasia. Gabriele. We can see here, come with me, my friend. We can see here your baby, your Hyperloop baby. You are going to, you are going every 6 months on a holiday trip to Elon Musk, to San Francisco because of the Hyperloop speed competition. You won it for the second or for the third time. Wow.
Yeah.
applause. The startup is coming from Germany.
Thank you very much.
On the first time, you know, Elon Musk, you will live together in the future, hopefully. What is important, what you are doing here, what is the USP of that baby you are creating?
Okay, so the thing is, the Hyperloop concept itself has been presented by Elon Musk in 2013. And since 2015, Elon Musk has been has introduced a competition. So there is a student competition that takes place almost once a year. It's not not every 6 months I get to go to California, but more or less once a year. And we have started, as many of other people sitting on the stage have done as well, a student group at the Technical University of Munich that is taking part in this competition. And the first competition was in January 2017, and since then this is the fourth iteration. And in particular, the last three competitions were about speed. So this pod solves the technical questions on how do you go the fastest on the test track that SpaceX has built. We'll in this way limit it in a way by the SpaceX track, but this capsule was able to reach 482 kilometers per hour in this track and win the last competition. And then what the group is, as I mentioned, a student group. We are at a university, and we are also have a research group that we are setting up, and we already started working on other solutions. So this we are showing here is the one we did for the competition, and then parallel to that we're working on other solutions, how we can go even faster. In particular, well, this capsule is still moving on wheels, because that's for the competition the best technical solution for even higher speed. As all guys mentioned already, linear motors and magnetic systems are the way to go to reach even faster speeds. And so we've built small prototypes. If you want to see levitating prototypes, we also have a stand where you can actually see the prototype levitating.
Is it exactly that baby who is going one term per year to Elon Musk?
We always build a new one. So every year we build a completely new one. This is the kind of third iteration of this concept of this electrically propelled vehicle. So this is a considerable evolution on what we did previous years.
Okay. Thank you, Gabriele.
I'll just take that.
And thanks for coming. I want to know what is the differentiation, the USP, what Hard Hyperloop has, what Hyper Poland has, and Celeros. What are your USP, and on which way you are working together? I heard you are working on a European Hyperloop implementation program. a little bit together. You know each other quite well. You have their mobile phone numbers, so you can connect each other in the future about what you are speaking.
We have a WhatsApp group, very active.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, first of all, it's important to know that we with all the Hyperloop companies in Europe and also one from Canada, Transpot, we have an agreement on standardization,
okay.
Which basically means that, you know, we coordinate all our communication to the European Commission, and in the end, we want to make sure that we work towards a single standardized system, at least in Europe, but ideally worldwide. We have a meeting every 2 or 3 months also at the European Commission with the head of interoperability of Rail, for example, the European Space, EASA, ERA. So the regulatory bodies of both aviation and rail are already there. So it's good to know at least that, you know, we are sitting there together and we want to make sure that there's a single standard, because that's in the end where most of the benefits of Hyperloop are going to come from. It's not just going to be those small pilot lines in some regions where you, of course, can bring some benefits, but the end benefits are going to be a network, for example, within Europe that you can really have have a replacement, for example, for all aviation within Europe for sort of a sustainable alternative. Of course, all the Hyperloop companies still are also in sort of development and showing what kind of technologies there are, sort of finding their way inside that market. So we're all building at least our own first test facilities now to in the end have that all combined into one big European test facility. So I can give a little bit of our perspective now from Hart. We have a test track in Delft, yeah, of 30 meters. So 30 meters obviously is not long enough to test at very high speeds. We can test levitation, stabilization, guidance, the propulsion, and also uniquely in the world, we can have a lane switch. You can imagine if you want to have a network within Europe, it's very important that you can switch lanes also at very high speeds. So we have something, what rail always have lane switches in the track. We basically have a lane switch where you select a track within the vehicle. So that means that you don't have all these moving components in the track, which again for maglev, yeah, was a few hundred meters of track, you know, bending the entire track around. That's something that we don't want to have if you have a switch every 50 kilometers or so, right?
Okay.
So that's one of our main unique features right now, this switch. We're basically now working within Europe on all these different routes to make sure that that all combines into one system.
Thanks a lot. Some comments, Zeleros?
I would like to add that I can't stress enough how important is the coordination and cooperation of this initiative, that all our companies from different countries work together into a single standardized solution. We are all in the development phase. We have sometimes very different solutions, but the important thing is that a project like this could be a flagship for Europe, at the time was the Airbus project, the first Airbus. Many years have passed, and now we are all together again, the Netherlands, Spain, Poland, Germany now. And it's important that we keep this coordination together in order to get the first solution, the best solution for all. Something that is for sure interoperable and that can cross frontiers without having to change catenary in the case of the trains or the gauge of the wheels. So let's get into a standard platform where we can all get the best solution for the whole system.
Great, thank you. It's quite warm here. Next time I have to change my jacket. Is 100% wood. Nee, Baumwolle, how to say it in English? Baumwolle?
Cotton.
It's cotton. So it's quite warm here. Yeah, it's like a sauna here, but we will spend enough time here. Yeah, I want to put it out, but yeah. It's etiquette in Germany, how to say it. So you have to wear it for the next 6 hours. But that's working time is lifetime. So I love it, what I'm doing. So, my friend, you are here right now. Thanks for coming. You started at 6 o'clock in Holland, 7 o'clock in the morning. Now you are here. Thanks for coming, Kai. Welcome on stage.
Thank you, Mark.
We have a chair.
We need a chair. Okay, du hast genug gesessen. You sat a long time in the train. Yeah. Do you want to have a stand-up meeting with me now? Is it possible?
Yeah, that's possible.
Come here. We have a place for you between that, guys. Wir haben hier ein Drehbuch vorbereitet und Sitzplätze, muss alles nach Plan laufen. Okay, thanks for coming, Kai. Kai, you worked for the last year for NS, for the train operator in Holland, and you supported to invest, to get an investment from NS into Hard Hyperloop. What was your idea in that investment case, what you did 2 years ago? Why you did it? Why you invested money and got a stake in Hard Hyperloop as NS, Holland train operator? Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanksgiving.
So I would say the reason for that was actually twofold.
Yeah.
On the one hand, NS is really about, say, developing sustainable travel. And of course, say, at this moment in time, the train is, say, from an NS perspective, the most important mode of transport. But we, or I'm still saying we, but it was them, it is them nowadays, it's my former employee, but yeah. NS is thinking from door to door. And in that sense, the train is only one of the solutions. And this is why NS considers it important to be involved in major innovations as Hyperloop is and could be. So that's one reason. The other reason is that also from a company's perspective, it's really relevant to be involved in developments like this, also for the NS employees to really work on, say, this type of innovations and actually deal with questions people are quite similar to, quite used to, but then in a slightly different context. So wow. Dealing with day-to-day questions in a different use case.
Wow, respect. Thanks for your direct and open answer. Yeah. Professor Rompf, you know how to work with asset-heavy puzzles. You know how to build up infrastructure. Which core challenge do you see when you hear the vision of these Hyperloop startups? They want to go forward in Europe, they want to go forward in Germany. What do you think is the challenge they have to work on when they are going from country to country?
I mean, obviously, there are some appealing features about the Hyperloop technology. It's about the velocity, about the speed, it's about the economies of scale, and it's about potentially riding emission-free. The basic challenge for me comes from the fact that in Europe we are talking about a completely new infrastructure that is in competition or at least in addition to the existing one. So I think you will face all kinds of challenges, starting from getting the technology stable, feasible, and robust. Then there will be some challenges of building the infrastructure and getting the acceptance for it.
Yeah.
And then there will be some challenges on the regulatory aspect. And I think there will be a final challenge of keeping your investors happy during all that time. Yeah. So a lot of challenges, I think. yeah, it's a good thing you're working on, but it'll take time. It'll be a marathon. It'll be no sprint, I suppose.
And do you see, Professor Rompf, do you see the Hyperloop development for transportation of goods and passengers, or only for goods? What is your stomach feeling about the Hyperloop technology, or you want to have it open?
It'll certainly be suitable for passengers, and the question is which kind of the existing logistics chain can be replaced by the Hyperloop. From my perspective, it'll be a good competition for air freight, whether it's a competition for rail cargo, for me it's hard to say, but I think there will be an expert next to me.
Yeah, thank you for the answer. One of the important questions is also, they are all important questions what we are discussing here for sure. Katharina, you are working together with some guys at Deutsche Bahn, and our vision is to start with a feasibility study, a Hyperloop feasibility study. Which role could play Deutsche Bahn in that game, in this Hyperloop ecosystem? Why you're doing it? What do you think why we are doing it? Yeah.
Yes. Well, I think a feasibility study is the beginning, because you just have to see what is what is he here? What is the technique? What is necessary for doing the operations from a commercial aspect? What are where do we come from? And I think we have a broad perspective we need from several aspects to know where we are talking about. And I think DB is very interested because if there is a new transport mode that is developing and perhaps cannibalizes our transport mode, then we have to know what is it exactly, what is the future perhaps, and what might be possible in the future.
So we have to speak with DB Fernverkehr and DB Schenker.
Yes, of course. From our point of view, as well, freight as well as passenger traffic is involved, and there are possibilities perhaps to start that. The other thing is perhaps for the beginning we have to look if the Hyperloop system fits in the existing network of DB or of the railways and could be something that is supporting the system or fits in and it would be integrated. Or the other point of view is that perhaps it will one day replace the system of railways, perhaps.
Okay, yeah, it's a good beginning, what we are doing right now, and the long way, Mars, yeah.
I'd like to quickly respond, because sometimes words come up like competition and cannibalization, you know, and it's sort of already almost polarizes something where I think actually, well, not just me, but also some of the smart modelists that we have also externally look at this, is that there might actually be cases where when you build a Hyperloop, you actually increase the share of rail in the entire modal shift. Because there are some places where if you use a Hyperloop between sort of a long distance, where some people might choose another modality, for example, either air or maybe driving, because you know the last miles may be a little bit more difficult. If you with a Hyperloop can cut down that longer distance by so much that more people choose to go for public transport, actually more people in the end use the entire rail/Hyperloop system. So it's also sort of interesting not to just look at, you know, how much does it take from rail, but looking at the entire modal shift, how much can it actually, you know, lead to an increase of, you know, rail usage in general, which is, I think, something that everybody is in favor of, so, sort of trying to get off of, you know, the private cars and more into, you know, more sustainable modes of transportation that have higher capacity.
Oh, thanks.
That would be the best solution, I think. And it's a challenge to find the right distances that could be integrated in such a system.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, depending on the distances, the other important point is which will be the final average speed of this system. So you think on corridors of, say, 500 to 1,000 kilometers, even more. It depends on each kind of the solutions. Actually, it could be thought as a threat, perhaps, mostly to the aeronautic companies, maybe for Lufthansa more than for Deutsche Bahn. But it's not it's not a threat for, we don't see it as a threat for Lufthansa, we see it as an opportunity because they will have a system on their portfolio that will be absolutely green, that will have a consumption much lower than it currently has, and that will eliminate most of the logistic time. And at the same time, will provide some of the functionalities the high-speed rail has. So it's not, on our view, it's not a threat for the railway, for the high-speed railway system. It's not a threat either for the air operators. It's mostly an opportunity for both. Always thinking on long distances, what we call long distances, something between 500 to 1,500 kilometers. Say, Paris to Berlin. Mm. Say, Berlin to Munich, say Berlin to Hamburg. I mean, there are very these city pairs in terms of aircraft transportation. They have a lot of people being carried a year, and we can replace that with a solution like a Hyperloop.
Thank you, Bertrand. You are studying since 2000. 14, approximately the Hyperloop ecosystem. In 2016, SNCF invested in Virgin Hyperloop a quite huge amount. Why you did it? Why you did it? And where you what? Yeah, where are you right now with that project, with Virgin Hyperloop and SNCF?
Yeah, thank you, Martin. Good morning, everybody. I'm very proud to be here to discuss with my colleagues of every railway company and Hyperloop companies in Europe. I think we have a common challenge to change the mobility. I will talk about freight because this is my specificity, but anyway, we need a solution for mobility for the future because our I would say feeling is that today, the mobility of today is not satisfying from a customer point of view, from a financial point of view, an operations point of view, and also from I would say efficiency point of view. So we have a lot of work to do in railways, in public transport, etc., to make the system sustainable, durable, more efficient, and more customers oriented. Dealing with SNCF in 2014, we were approached by Virgin Hyperloop. It was the beginning of Hyperloop initiatives.
Yeah.
And we were approached by Hyperloop because we had more than 30 years of experience in high-speed operations, safety, completely safe, without any accident, and moreover, with more than 1 billion of passengers inside our trains. And this is a point I would like to highlight, is that it's not because you have the technology and the mobile, the vehicles, that you are able to be one of the major players in terms of mobility. Because where you are operating mobility, you need to manage physical flows, financial flows, and information flows. And this is quite important to know that it's not because you have the vehicles that you are a good player in mobility. That's a question. The technology should be there, but the operation of the technology is another thing. And it's a question of experience, management, operation, safety, etc., etc. And this is our common challenge, to shift from technological point of view to operational point of view. So Hyperloop, Virgin Hyperloop, was very interesting to have this kind of, I would say, return of experience. And at this moment, in 2016, it was quite, in France we say a pari, a bargain, to say, okay, this will be one of the major players in the future. So we invested in Hyperloop, Virgin Hyperloop at this moment. But to be honest, we are looking every initiative in this kind of thing. I have to say also that we have one headquarter, one office in San Francisco. SNCF 574 in San Francisco is open there, and we are looking what is running on in the in the Silicon Valley, and also mainly initiative around mobility and digital.
Okay, thank you. Let us spend much more time to speak about the core challenges you have right now and what are the next steps you are planning with the Hyperloop initiatives. So, Mars, what is your next core challenge and your next Leuchtturm, your next target, you are working on?
Sure. So in general, I think the biggest challenge for Hyperloop is basically that before we will ever really get any benefits, you will have to make enormous investments, many billions of investment before you ever get any benefits. We will only ever do these investments if there's very broad support from different layers from society, both from technical, from transport providers, from the public sector, from the people, that something like this is a good idea before you will ever get these investments.
Yeah.
And we will only ever get that support if we can also sort of prove that it works. You know, that people can feel it and see it, and that they can sit inside one and say, hey, this is something that works. So you need to do that. That's where the challenge is, because in order to do that, you already need quite a lot of infrastructure investment just to show that it works. So you're almost sort of in a catch-22 loop situation where we need to get some investments, but those are only done by, people usually invest in technology if they see, hey, there's a client who wants to buy it, right? But here the clients still want to see first that the technology works, but if that costs many millions, you need to get that first. So one challenge now is, how do you sort of collaborate, pool your resources, how do you phase it in such a way that every time you can raise enough investment just to show enough sort of substantial, that you can raise the next investment and then build out that proof so that at some point you'll have everybody behind it and then it will take off. So for us also, our next step is to really do a next step in all those different facets in terms of regulatory framework, setting up standards. Secondly, building a full-scale Hyperloop vehicle where people can really sit inside, feel how it works, yeah, and so on.
Social acceptance.
Thirdly is we're about to build a new test track of about 3 kilometers where we can really test at high speeds so that we can also show that all those technologies work. And finally, really working together with local stakeholders on very specifically what could a route bring to that region, how to bring it from idea to implementation, and sort of, you know, play on those 4 chessboards at the same time. So that will then again allow us to raise another investment to get closer and closer to that actual entire proof of concept.
What is your advice? What should Deutsche Bahn do in the Hyperloop ecosystem for the next steps? What is your recommendation, your advice to Deutsche Bahn? I'm here as a truffle searcher and mediator and moderator today. So give them advices, please.
Well,
that would be great.
I think, you know, I can give this advice, but you already came up with it yourself. You know, that a first good step is to really do at least an internal study for Deutsche Bahn to see we have all this infrastructure already. We will need to invest in the longer term. What's our role going to be in that? You know, what's our role going to be also if there would be a Hyperloop? And what kind of effect could Hyperloop have on our infrastructure and on generally on what it could do for, you know, German mobility? Of course, within a context of European network. I think that's one of a very, very good thing to do, to just do an assessment of that from yourself internally. I also think within engineering and consultancy, there's a lot of experience to really do a lot of the technical assessments of that. So I think that's, you know, you should always start with, does it actually make sense to do this? And we are convinced of that, but you need to also see for yourself sort of what the results could be. So doing that study is definitely a first step. And I think for the longer term, it just makes a lot of sense to, you know, have the developers, the private sector, and the different transport companies to look together on how you can phase these test facilities and see if there's some kind of, you know, collaborations possible there. But I think it starts with making sure that what we're doing makes sense in the longer term, and then developing a roadmap together on how to realize it. Yeah.
So we need rapid regulations, rapid Gesetzesentwürfe in Germany. So when you say the social acceptance and the regulations is always like a showstopper in that game. Do you are working on and do you are connecting with the political members and the infrastructure funds and like that you are going on? Kasia, Mars or Zelerus, you are working on that to give them a massage that they are open enough to support you?
Well, this is why we do it mostly on European level now, the regulatory framework. We really believe that is something that we need to at least do at European level, make sure that the standards are set at European level and that the regulatory framework sort of, you know, points towards those standards to make sure that is European. And all countries are going to do their own route development. But it would be really nice that at least on a European level, there's a regulatory framework and sort of a vision that, you know, there's sort of a mandate for countries to develop something within that framework. That I think you would do on European level, but really the development of the routes, that should be much more, I think, on a country level. Because also, if you're going to try to build the first routes cross-country, it's good to have that context. But to really start working on it, it's just going to slow it down, I believe. And as long as the framework is the same, it's good.
And your dream is to connect mega cities or cities, which could be the first route
you want to connect. Martin. It's not just a dream, Martin. It's a plan.
I'm here. Yeah. Right now, I'm not sleeping. Kasia, do you want to connect Warsaw with Amsterdam, or what is your dream? You can meet in the middle. It could be Berlin. What could be a first track you're working on?
So I think that's a little bit too far in the future, I must say, because our solution is quite different than the Hyperloop at this point of development. So as we are using the existing railway infrastructure, we are heading for logistics and cargo transport right now, because this is about these operational problems. Like the idea of the Hyperloop is really nice that we can go from Paris to Warsaw within 1.5 hours and then live in one city and work in another one. But that's not enough for the infrastructure projects. And when it comes to return on investment, infrastructure projects are really tricky on that. So you really need to think more where it could work. And of course, it would be lovely to have the connection between Warsaw and Paris via Berlin and Frankfurt and then later on to Amsterdam. But this will not happen within the next 10 years. We will not promise that. So from our perspective, it's more to concentrate on the logistics sector right now because there are the huge problems. We are talking about the road transport, which is right now taking more than 75% of the whole freight transport in Europe. We want to work for other generations as well. We have a huge problems with CO2 emissions or the noise pollution as well. So these are the problems that we want to address. We, with our solutions, can actually have an impact of how many of the high-duty vehicles are moving on the European roads, and that's our first goal. The last goal will be to move the passengers from Warsaw to Amsterdam, but there are many stops on the way that we have to go through to show also that the system works, that it's operational, that it actually makes sense, and then we will go to the long distance travel.
Great, thank you. Professor Maas, we spoke about the Hyperloop is a asset-heavy stuff. Professor Rumpf, Professor Maas. It's a podium discussion tomorrow for Cyborg with Professor Maas. Sorry, you are Professor Rumpf. Sorry for that. Professor Rumpf, we spoke about the mindset. When we are speaking about the Hyperloop stuff, it's asset-heavy. Do you think we need a long-term perspective and a long-term mindset for that Hyperloop cases on the investment side in Germany? So that dream can come true? What do you think? Do we have the financing stuff and the investors in Germany to build it up in the European Hyperloop ecosystem?
This for me is hard to judge. From my perspective, we are talking at least about a European project here. We are not talking about a project that can be handled by one country. Only Europe is too densely populated to create a business case from my perspective. I'm not the expert, but my gut feel is it's a European thing we are talking about.
Yep.
And from my perspective, to keep the private investors happy for a longer period of time, and my gut feel is we are talking about 15 to 20 years here, is to have strong government support. So if I was in your position, I would go to the new selected EU Commission and ask for some money and for some support there. From what I read, they have big bucks sitting in their pockets. They are talking about 1,000 billion euros. Yeah. And maybe you can come up with some of their funds to keep your private investors happy.
I think I would really agree with the previous speaker that, say, I think one of the biggest debates in Europe at this moment is how are we looking at the future of aviation on a European level? And I think we know that with a high-speed train, we can probably cover distances up to 700, 800 kilometers. And say, for distances that are longer, it's difficult to compete on journey time. And of course, that is definitely where Hyperloop comes in. And I think now, still in Brussels, say, they are looking at Europe. And when it comes to, say, an alternative to flying on those distances, they are looking at a high-speed rail network. And I think this it is about time now to have the conversation, is it about expanding that high-speed rail network and putting all the billions into that? Or is it maybe a combination of that? I'm not saying you should stop investing in high-speed rail, but maybe the future should have two tracks.
Two tracks. And in your vision, there should be an extra infrastructure for goods or passenger transportation, or could it be the same? Or we are spending a lot of money for renovierung of our old infrastructure right now in Germany for the next 20 to 30 years. what we should do with the money in Germany. What is your advice?
Say, maybe looking at it from a Dutch perspective, we do see that there is always, say, on the tracks, on the railway tracks, there's always a competition between, say, regional traffic, national traffic, and international traffic. And I think the type of thinking that's needed is really having a vision on those three different segments.
Okay.
And then mainly, especially from a Dutch perspective, when it comes to the international connections, you should really think about, do we still see the train there as the main mode of transport on each and every route, or do we see specific routes where Hyperloop could be the solution?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I would like to highlight this point. It's very important. And I would like also to join with what Kasia said about the challenge of sustainability. At the beginning of transport in the, I would say, century, near 16th century, there was the humans, then the horses, then the train, then the road.
And then telepathy.
And not the teletransportation one day, one not, but not. But we are at the era of the road. Mm. But what is very different in the last 40 years is that the internationalization of the commerce and then the mondialization made the maritime shipping and then the road transport as the key transport everywhere in the world.
Okay.
And the dealing with goods traffic, the rail freight lost its efficiency and it was more or less focused on the, I would say, the raw materials for industry and then the first part of the supply chain coming from the factories. But the train is no more placed on the distribution. That means the last mile and distribution, no more today. And this is one of the reasons, you are right, we are less than 15% of average transport in Europe. That's a key point because I think, the Commission said recently that rail must be the backbone of mobility for the future, especially in freight. And that's very important to understand that today the situation is more than 80-85% of the transport, of the land transport in Europe is made by road, which means congestion, which means noise, which means death, premature death, which means pollution, and it's not sustainable for the future. And when you are looking at the next 10 years, one of the key points is that if we do nothing, there will be billions of trucks more running in Europe, and this 30% of more trucks will occur some noise, death, etc., etc. It's not possible for our children to do like that. So the point is, we need to be back in the logistic chain everywhere in long transport for long distance at least, and major lines. So we should be the rail backbone of mobility. We need to transfer this new freight from road to rail. And moreover, what we discovered, and this is something which we shared between all the stakeholders in Europe, is that today every citizen is paying for the situation. That means you are paying, we are paying for the road. And that's the question. If we shift this amount of additional traffic to rail, we will make economy, savings. That's incredible. We have hundred billions of savings when we will transfer this freight from road to rail, because less pollution, because less congestion, because less premature deaths, etc., etc. And this is the point, and this is the reason why with every stakeholders in Europe with rail freight, that means DB Cargo, Trenitalia, SBB Cargo, everywhere player in Europe, we gathered in one initiative which is called Rail Freight Forward. And if you are looking at the website, we'll have all these kind of figures. And we are now gathering and we are running this idea that rail must be the backbone of mobility for logistics for the next 10 years. And I think in that case, when we will look at logistics, supply chain efficiency, then Hyperloop concept will appear because some of our customers need very high speed connection for very small parcels, and we are not placed on this kind of thing today. So there is a lack of mobility on this kind of traffic.
Thank you. I see there are a lot of questions, Herr Zakis, Mr. Zakis. Should we open the discussion round right now? Because people have questions, I feel.
Yes, please. Maybe we'll start with the questions that are already here on the screen. Just help me. I think some of them might have been answered. There was the question in the difference of technology to the Polish Hyperloop. I think you already mentioned a little bit, a different focus. Maybe you want to elaborate with one or two sentences.
Sure. Maybe it's actually easier to show it on this model. So Martin, if you could just
help me a little bit,
so we can just show it. That's the vehicle which can be later on used in the Hyperloop system. So basically right now we can move with that on the existing infrastructure using the magnetic levitation and the linear arm motor, and if you can help me, that's this third, the orange track, a rail in between the normal rail tracks. And for that, so that's basically what we need to update the existing railway infrastructure. We need to build on the linear motor inside. And with this solution, the normal conventional trains can move on the tracks without any changes in their rolling stock, and we can move with our MagRail vehicle as well on the same tracks. We can move with the speeds of 300 to 415 kilometers per hour. So that's the major difference, that we are actually moving faster than a high-speed rail. But for the high-speed rail lines, you need the new infrastructure mostly to be built to reach the speeds of over 250 kilometers per hour. We don't need that. The second stage, you can put it back. It's heavy.
I'm doing sports, so it's okay for me. Thank you.
The second stage is basically leaving everything what's in here, so the upgrade for the infrastructure and the vehicle itself, and we can add the vacuum tube. But this is the solution when the conventional trains cannot move on this infrastructure anymore, obviously. So this is not the solution for every single track. And I would say that the Hyperloop system will never be the major competition for railways, because the Hyperloop system will never take over the regional trains. This is the connection between the big cities when the high speed is the major advantage. So this is the second. If we add this vacuum tube to this system, we can move with the speeds from 600 to 1,000 kilometers per hour. The Hyperloop, in theory, is meant to be moving up to 1,200 kilometers per hour. But for that, we need the new infrastructure. So we can actually implement our system much faster. We are counting on the pilot projects in 3 years from now. We are going to build a one-to-one test track next year on the existing infrastructure. Exactly. And the second so we can test the technology, which will later on be used in the stage one and the Hyperloop itself. But we can implement it and test it much faster than actually developing the technology and waiting for the new infrastructure for Hyperloop to be built.
Thank you.
I see Katharina leaning in and watching closely. There's a question in your direction. Is DB considering working together with a Polish solution?
Yes, sure. It sounds very well, and it would be the most suitable, I think, technique. But right now it's very difficult for us to get enough information how the system really works. There are some papers published in magazines, but we have really on the internet, we cannot really get the information we know to really understand the system. So I would very much like to get in contact with my colleague in Poland, because it sounds very well, yes.
Thank you.
Maybe a follow-up question, just also talking about the Polish solution. How do you ensure passenger comfort if you raise the speed above the conventional trains? How do you integrate it into existing rail CSS environment?
Everybody can answer. But you start.
I'll start. So we need for this solution to be working and speeding up to 300, 400 kilometers an hour, we need to maintain the existing infrastructure to the standard of the trains moving up to 160 kilometers per hour. This means that we also need to maintain the control systems and power systems. Similarly, when it's done for the high-speed rail, we need to close the one-level intersections, which is also done for the high-speed rail. So basically, we need to do some changes in the system, but it doesn't mean that we cannot move without making these changes. It only depends on the speed. So basically, if we need to go on the track, which is not modernized up to 160 kilometers per hour, will not reach the speed of 300 kilometers per hour.
Thank you. A question to all of you, I suppose. Are there already tests run with passengers on board? And if so, at what speed?
No.
No?
Short answer, you save time.
No.
No, this is sort of, we never written this down, but this is sort of a non-written agreement between all the Hyperloop companies that you simply don't do that. It's you would start doing that once there is sort of a certain level of safety of certification before you start putting passengers in these things. So none of the, I mean, we're not planning any tests for quite a few years now, still ahead, where we still won't be doing anything with passengers. I think that would be, you know, somewhere halfway next decennium, where you might be at the pace where you could do something like that. But mm-hmm. You know, the biggest, imagine that something would go wrong now because you haven't done the whole certification. Then you basically put the whole Hyperloop development, you put a dent on it, and that would be not only for the development but also for this person. You know, it's just something you don't do now. Yeah, mm-hmm. No, you need to go through certification first.
We have here somebody from the University of Emden, and there is already a 25 kilometer long track for the Transrapid, like a test track. We can maybe use it also in Germany. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, no problem.
What we can find there, and can we use it for the next step?
Yeah, of course we can. What we basically have in the Emsland is we have the Transrapid test track from the innovations that have been done there. And there's a lot of technology that we can use. There's magnetic levitation, there's magnetic propulsion. There's basically a track. The only thing that we have to do is put a tube around it and put a vacuum in there so we can actually test the Hyperloop there. And that's in addition to what Mars has said before. So he mentioned the 3 kilometers test track. Some of you did. So that's the initial stage, and you want to see how good it goes, how you do levitation, that's how you do lane switching, that's what he said. But the question is, how do you do that at high speeds, and how can you reach high speeds? You need a long track, so that's what we want to do there, and that's what we want to use the existing infrastructure of a good research network, because in Germany we all have to work together at the end, and we have to coordinate our research so we can have one central place for that, and that would probably be Laatten and in the Emsland, where there's already a place, where there's already a lot of research set up, so we can all use this stuff together.
And can we come to you for a weekend to see what's happened there, and that what is your need to Deutsche Bahn, what is their need to the Hyperloop experts, that we can rebuild it together and to upgrade it and to use it what we want to do?
That's just a question of money, I guess. So let's get some funding done and we can do that. We're actually working together with some of you guys. We've just written applications to the EU that we can. We are designing the test facility there that we will how we want to modify this test facility that we need, how much money we will need in order to do that. And to get this test facility running and to get a European research center up. Because we all in Europe, I guess we all need to work together. You said that if you want to travel from one country to the other one, you have to have the same track. You can't just change tracks. That's impossible to do. So we have to have the same standards. And I guess we are looking at Virgin Hyperloop 1, and we are looking at Hyperloop Transport Technologies, the bigger ones, which are over from Los Angeles. So if we want to outcompete them or like have a standard in Europe, we all need to work together and find a common research center. And that's what we actually want to do, have a research center where industry meets research. And that's what we can do there.
So Gabriele can stay in Germany for the speed competition.
Of course.
You don't need anymore to go to his papa,
yes,
Mr. Elon Musk.
That's what he actually just realized. Like last year, we've also been competing at the Hyperloop Pod competition together with you guys. But of course, Munich is best. So congratulations to you. But yeah, we said last year that we don't want to compete anymore in the competition because that's not the real imagination of the Hyperloop. That's probably what you, Mars, would also say to that. So we wanted to focus on the research and get the Hyperloop actually going. And that's where we would do it. And that's how we would do it.
Okay.
There's so a question that relates to that. Speaking of corporations, is there a Chinese Hyperloop and are there corporations with China?
There are some developments ongoing in China. They have a master plan, let's say, that works on standard maglev, 600 kilometers per hour maglev, 800 kilometers per hour maglev, and then also on a Hyperloop solution based on superconducting maglevs and so. So they are also on the run. It's normal. I mean, they have to cover distances that really go beyond the 1,000 kilometers, so it's also interesting for them. The level of development is, well, not that high. I mean, they have developments, but they are not functional yet. I would like to add one point in terms of the certification and safety that we discussed before, and also related to these Chinese developments. Currently, for certification for the aircrafts, the pressure level, the equivalent pressure level, it's for a plane flying at 14,000 meters. That's the A380, and that was an exception. All the Hyperloop solutions go, all excepting that from Celeros, go beyond that height. They go between 40, 50, depends on each case, kilometers over the Earth. There is no certification for that. In our case, in the solution from Celeros, we are working at a pressure level that is roughly that of the Concorde, which makes certification in terms of safety and in terms of bringing passengers in more easy. I'm not saying it's going to be immediate, but it's easier. And this is why we also think that combining, we don't have linear motors, and combining this terms of safety, that is also a solution, a proposal that could be considered.
There's a question that relates directly to that. How do you approach challenges regarding safety in, for example, decompression, steel thermal expansion, or evacuation, especially with HARTS elevated system?
I'll address all of them. One, I'll start with the expansion point. It's funny that this became such a big issue. I think the reason was that because in the first paper of Elon Musk, his expansion idea was that at the end of the station, you would have the tube expanding 500 meters in and out, which we always thought was a little bit of a weird solution. I think a lot of people read this and thought, that's a weird solution. That doesn't work. But if you look at actual expansion joints that are on the market for pipelines, they exist of this size. So expansion joints are simply sort of think of a little trumpet piece between two tubes that can just take up the expansion. The expansion joint is actually not a very complex component. So that's one that's not really a big problem. However, the decompression case is actually the one that, according to our failure mode and effect analysis, is the most important case. You know, for example, the door of a Hyperloop vehicle, that's something that opens quite often because that's used in every cycle. such a component while operation is obviously one of the most crucial components that it always works, because if a door opens while you're in a tube, you would get decompression of the vehicle, and that is of course an unsafe situation for the passengers. So in order to, first of all, of course you need to do everything possible to make sure that that's actually not a case that can happen, but if something like that happens, that there is always a way in which you can very rapidly repressurize the tube. And so that there's a way where you can segmentize a piece of the tube and repressurize that within a time frame where it could ever be a dangerous situation for the passengers. And exactly these kinds of things are why these test facilities are now so important, because you want to already test the solutions that we've come up with that and see whether they work. And if not, that we can already iterate on those and only start spending the real money once you've sort of solved all these issues, which are obviously the biggest ones for long-term safety issues. Yep. I think those were the main sort of safety questions, right?
Evacuation was one question.
So for in our case, we really believe that you need to be able to also get people out of the vehicle, out of the tube. So you need to be able to turn the tube into a normal tunnel, and then you follow the same procedures that you would usually have for people to get out of a tunnel.
Mm-hmm. In our case, we see it in a different way. First of all, we only need oxygen masks, same as on a plane, an airplane. So in that case, in our case, it's solved in that system. And what refers to how to evacuate people or the vehicle, what we do is that we bring the vehicle out of this main circuit. We consider that putting segmentations in the tube, in the main way, or in the main line, could create a trouble. If one of the doors closes and then you are running at a high speed, you may crash, if that could happen. So we want to avoid that case. And in the same way, we also want to, the first time we have a problem with decompression, we bring the vehicle out. We don't have to stop the operation because we have closed the a section of the main line. And in addition, we don't want to make the people run on a tunnel for kilometers and kilometers, because this is the problem for a long distance. It's not a small tunnel under a mountain where you have to maybe, with your chair wheel, do 2 kilometers. In this case, you will need to do 5-10 kilometers or put a lot of emergency exits. So our solution is bring the vehicle out, make sure you can bring the vehicle out from time to time, and that way you can ensure that you will always have the capability of bringing the passengers out on a safety environment.
So some next question from the audience, yes?
Yeah, I think, hopefully, because some people, they don't have an iPhone or a mobile phone here, so they can't connect to the television there. Some questions from the audience. Somebody who is introverted, I come to you.
In the meanwhile, I'll continue with a question from the screen. No? What are geographic limitations in building this new technology, speaking about crossing rivers and mountains or other things? Earthquake areas.
That's all things that need to be considered. What would be definitely a challenge is that if you go at very high speeds, then you obviously need to go in a straight line in the ideal scenario. So the straighter the track that connects to city, the better, the faster you can go. The moment you start have curves, and the other thing is obvious geographical limitations that we were saying, nothing is a plane, so you cannot draw a perfect line and go straight on it. You will have to consider height differences, you will have to consider curve radiuses and so on, and that will obviously limit the way you can build tracks and obviously the speed that this is going to go. So this is actually something that you need to be very careful about. The other crucial point about it is that you want to build it above the earth. I think we should agree on that, because above the earth is generally considerably cheaper than building a tunnel. The second best solution to build it above the earth, to be able to do a hole, put the tube in, and then close the hole again. This is what is tried to be done when you have to build a tunnel and you have the opportunity. Obviously, if there is a mountain, you just need to drill a hole, and that's the most expensive solution to that. So this is all kind of limitations that we have to address and that need to be addressed when you're actually planning routes. Just a little bit to what we are doing, because I wasn't able to say it before, and then I was told I'm only going to Elon Musk, and that's actually not the case looking forward. So the same thing as was mentioned, we are very much looking into the research side now, and also decided to not to take part in future competition. First of all, because future competition are not announced yet, and the second thing is that thanks to the student activities that started at the Technical University of Munich, we have now convinced the university to start a research group at the university focused on this kind of problem. So modeling this kind of tracks, trying to understand, okay, what are the limitations? How straight can the line be? How much is it needed as a straight line? What kind of curves can we do if we don't do a straight line, and this kind of issues?
Great.
There's more questions here. Maybe the price questions. Prices for maintenance, like how much will be the cost for track maintenance and also the operational cost for the vehicles?
No, I'm not going to throw numbers. No, no. I think the best way to look at this is qualitatively, which is basically that, you know, one of the nice things of magnetic levitation is principally that there's no friction between track and vehicle. So that means that there's, you know, less. There's no friction. There's no degradation there. So that is a lower maintenance principally than steel on steel contact. Of course, you still need to have a very straight track, so you would probably often have to have a vehicle go through it to check the track and maybe realign it, which is similar to something you also have with high-speed rail. The tube itself, of course, protects all the components within the Hyperloop, you know, the tracks, the motor, and so on. So that's also there decreases sort of the maintenance cost for that. So qualitatively, there's you know, there's some reasons why the maintenance cost may be lower than some other modalities. But it's also important to sort of note that for a lot of the alignments, at least that we've been looking at, you're following a sort of a similar alignment than rail and highway. So you can also combine such a maintenance contract, which then sort of as a combination for both infrastructures decreases the overall costs rather than if they would be completely separate. In terms for the vehicle itself, again, it's in a completely closed environment, so there's very little stuff that comes from outside that interacts with the vehicle. And inside the vehicle, you know, it's very similar to sort of being inside an airplane. So you would obviously need to make sure that it's always, all the technical systems are safe. You do a lot of maintenance cycles for that. But that's, yeah, there's not...
Speaking about money, how much do you think will a ride be? What is it comparable with a normal train, plane, taxi?
Very important question. In all the studies we did, we get positive socioeconomic benefits, you know, versus the costs. If you take ticket prices, they are competitive with all the other modalities. So if you are talking about a long distance trip, we are competitive with aviation tickets. For short distance trips, we are competitive with rail tickets.
I don't know, an aviation ticket to Copenhagen from Frankfurt at the moment is 20 euros if you book EasyJet or 50 euros, so you will beat
exactly
that price?
No, so we will not definitely, we will definitely not have every ticket be 20 euros, but that's also not the case with aviation now. If you look at the average costs, that's also where we are at, and we really believe in an open system, and I definitely believe there will be Easy Pods and Ryan Pods going in there, who might be offering, you know, a service where people are all standing, and you know, for a lower price. It, you know, this is sort of future thinking. You will get sort of an open market. You will get an open market, and you will have differences in prices as well, and differences in services.
Will you also have differences by the people using it? How is it for old people, young people? A question here, like, do they have special needs when traveling with the system?
I think principally, every new modality that is developed now takes you know, complete, how do you call this? Equal, you develop it in such a way that, you know, you take it into account that everyone can use it. You know, so you have places for wheelchairs, thank you. Yeah, you have places for wheelchairs. You don't have like big step ups for people to get on. It's, you know, it needs to be developed that way.
Yeah, I would like to make in our case, for the operational cost, we go from 3 to 5 times less than an airplane for a comparable route. I mean, it's not the same to compare 500 kilometers to 100 kilometers. And it's not the same when you use a vehicle for 50 people than when you use a vehicle for 150 people, because the cost per kilometer and seat changes. But all in all, we can say 3 to 5 times less than an airplane. I think this is the most, in terms of operation cost, the most relevant data. We also have to add that anything that has to do with the vacuum pumps and all the energizing of the vacuum pumps, we can do it through windmills or solar panels or from other energies. It is not, I mean, it's not, we would like to have always green energies, but it's not sometimes we who decide on that. But the consumption, the energy consumption from the pumps can be covered by solar panels over the vehicle or windmills next to the vehicle. And we could even get positive grid balance from these solar panels. And in terms of accessibility, well, it's a vehicle that is going to be designed with the criteria needed for the 21st century. We are not going to design a vehicle with criteria from with all criteria, yeah. Let's say.
Last question, maybe quick answer, Bertrand. What are your ideas for freight and Hyperloop?
And I just have 2 minutes for that. That's the point. I think rail freight, maritime freight will stay the major mode in Europe and in the world for the future. That's the point. But I think that where there is a lack and where it is today difficult, it's where we are talking about urban logistics. Everybody here in this audience is a customer of Alibaba, Wish, Amazon, what you want. If you are talking about the road transport and the small vehicles that are provisioning your buyings, there is half of the truck is not full. We are losing more than 150% of the capacity with this kind of traffic. So there are a lot of vehicles everywhere, but they are not fully loaded. And what you are looking is that there are more and more vehicles because we have ordered more and more small parcels. And the problem is that we are congestioning the road. So the municipalities, the cities, will stay at a moment, stop. We won't accept small vehicles, and they will also say no more diesel in the cities. So in the next 5 to 10 years to come, In my perspective, I can imagine that the cities won't accept this kind of delivery that we have today. And there will be a lack because everybody at this moment would like to have more and more buying and more order in a few minutes of delivery. And this is the point where there will be some problems in the metropolitan cities. And I think such kind of thing, Hyperloop, could be used from the logistics platform to the internal space of cities, and I think this is where the backbone could be used. So it's quite different from the passenger perspective, in my opinion. There will be, due to the environment ecosystems, there will be a lack of system for penetrating the cities in the next 10 years. I'm fully convinced of that. Anyway, cities will organize and manage themselves the flows, I think. So they are more and more taking up the fueling of lorries. And more, I can imagine that this kind of transport, last mile transport, will be more and more not public, but public regulatory made, I think, the future.
Thanks a lot, Bertrand. I think at this point we'll wrap up. And if there still is a question open, please don't hesitate to approach anyone in the panel in the next minutes. So it's interesting to see, very promising to see that all of you are in communication and working together on the project. It sounds like it's still going to be a lot of years until we see real things that are usable, tested by humans. And I'm sure until then, probably there's also going to be a lot of changes between the players, maybe new players coming, consolidation of the different approaches. So it's going to be an interesting topic to follow. Also interesting to see the emancipation from the original Musk concept, that it's taking its own ways now. Thanks for joining us today and giving us these insights. Martin, something to add?
No. Thanks for your time and patience. It was a great discussion round, also emotionally, what I really like. Thanks for your time. The panelists will stay here for the next 10 minutes for you so you can connect each other there in the lounge. And I won't make a picture because it's like a premiere that all the core Hyperloop initiatives in Europe are on one stage. So we should do a picture together for Ernst Fröhlich. My son will come maybe soon. No, we should do a picture all together. And thanks for your openness and kindness. Tomorrow we will have a podium discussion on the topic Cyborg here at the same time. So we are also warmly welcome. The podium discussion tomorrow will be in German language, my mother tongue or mother language. So with much more emotions and entertaining stuff. So enjoy. Thanks for being here. And yeah, you can searching more truffles here in the hall. Thanks for coming.
Big applause for our panel. Thanks a lot. So we'll take a break of 7 minutes, and then at 2:30, we'll continue here with the next session of startup pitches. So we have 5 more startups coming today, presenting their solutions and competing for today's prizes. So be back in 7 minutes for the next round of startup pitches.
Thank you.